On the morning of Wednesday, June 11th, 2003, 9-year-old Christian Ferguson mysteriously vanished. His father, Dewan, placed a call to 911 to report that his SUV had been stolen and that his son was in the vehicle at the time. The vehicle was later recovered by police, and it was noted that while several valuable items had been left behind, the child was the only thing missing. What began as the hunt for a missing child would slowly transform into an investigation of his father, the man charged with taking care of him, as evidence began gathering, suggesting that Dewan knew exactly what had happened to his son. Dewan was ultimately charged with first-degree murder 16 years later in 2019. In today's episode, we'll cover the trial, the verdict, and what comes next. In addition, we will touch upon revelations in two other cases. There is the infamous Christmas Tree Lady, also known as the Annandale Jane Doe. On December 18, 1996, her lifeless body was discovered in the child section of a Virginia cemetery. The woman, who carried no identification, had seemingly planned out her death and left money and a note behind requesting that she be cremated without being identified. For more than 25 years, the mystery of her life and her death has haunted investigators and the local community. Now, after all of this time, the amazing researchers over at Othram Labs have positively identified her as Joyce Marilyn Meyer Summers. Finally, on Friday, June 18, 1982, 20-year-old mother of one, Kelly Berg Dove, disappeared from her overnight shift at the Imperial Gas Station in Harrisonburg, Virginia. After a series of 911 calls in which Kelly grew progressively more scared, police arrived on the scene to find the gas station abandoned. There was no trace of Kelly, nor where she may have gone, or who might have been responsible. Now, 40 years later, investigators have released audio from one of her 911 calls in hopes of drumming up more attention and tips. In addition to this, cold case detectives have announced their belief that they have finally narrowed the suspect pool down to just one person, and a composite sketch has been made available. This is Trace Evidence, Major Case Updates. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we will look back at three cases previously featured on Trace Evidence, which have had major developments in the past few weeks. Before getting into those developments, just a few quick notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. In Harrisonburg, Virginia, Kelly Berg Dove disappeared while working the overnight shift at a gas station. Just out of St. Louis, Missouri, Christian Ferguson vanished when his father alleged that the 9-year-old was in his car when it was stolen. Back in Virginia, the identity and life of the Annandale Jane Doe has been the source of great mystery and intrigue for more than 20 years. Now, with her identity revealed, the mystery has begun to unravel. We will now examine these three major case updates. Trace Evidence, Episode 95, The Annandale Jane Doe. December 18, 1996 began as a cool and breezy morning in Annandale, Virginia. While snow hadn't yet begun to blanket the area, residents could feel the nights growing more cold and the wind howling louder. The town was adorned with decorations for the coming holiday season. Red bows and green wreaths dotted light poles and storefronts. Christmas lights blinked through the early evenings before going dark as homeowners clicked off the power and went to bed. In the morning, as some locals were up preparing for the day ahead, making their ways to work or school, others remained in their beds, wrapped up in the warmth of their blankets, in the comfort of their own bedrooms. However, there was at least one person who would not awaken, and would instead pass away sometime between the transition from the darkness of night to the pale pink breaking light of morning. Pleasant Valley Memorial Park is located to the west of Annandale proper at 8420 Little River Turnpike. Spanning 13 acres, the cemetery was opened in 1963 when the estate of George Simmons was sold to a group of developers looking to create a cemetery, which, according to its website, was designed for people of all backgrounds, traditions, and faiths. Typically, deaths lead to cemeteries, and whether solved or unsolved, stone markers bear the names of those who have been lost, be it due to age, circumstance, their own hand, or that of another. Many stones stand etched with the names of those whose final moments have never been fully understood, nor the method of their loss completely defined. Many unknown stories end in the cemetery, but on that brisk December morning, Pleasant Valley Memorial Park would become the start of a mystery, which has caught the attention of hundreds of thousands of researchers and true crime aficionados. Detectives Mike Headley and Richard Perez were given an assignment at approximately 9 a.m. that morning to head over to the cemetery to investigate a bizarre scene discovered by employees working that morning. They'd arrive less than an hour after receiving the assignment. In a newer section of the memorial park, one specifically designed to house the graves of children, the body of an adult female had been found. When the detectives arrived on the scene, they were somewhat struck by what they were looking at. An unidentified white female lay on her back atop a clear plastic sheet, which had been laid out like a picnic blanket. The woman was clearly deceased, but to the surprise of investigators, her skin was still warm to the touch, suggesting that her time of death had been recent. Not far from where she lay, detectives saw a small 8-inch-tall Christmas tree, which had apparently been erected by the unknown woman. The tree was green, and according to Namus, had been decorated with gold balls and red ribbons. Lying nearby was a portable cassette player, the headphones of which were on the victim's ears, and inside of the player was a cassette of the famous 2,000-year-old man routine, as performed by Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks. In hopes of finding some further information that might give them a clue to the victim's identity, the detectives picked up a green backpack which was lying near the victim and searched through it. The contents did little to shine light on the mystery, as inside all they found were two empty juice bottles, peach and mango flavored, a roll of masking tape, and two additional cassettes, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and Jeff Foxworthy's You Might Be a Redneck. Considering the grim circumstances, there was certainly a lot of comedy around. One item I've seen present in photos of Jane Doe's personal effects is a small, bright pink pouch, sort of like what I grew up knowing as a fanny pack, a small bag which is worn around the waist. This particular one has an image of Minnie Mouse on it, with hearts along the strap. It looks like something that would belong to a child, perhaps another clue to suggest the possibility of motherhood or a lost child. What I find most fascinating about the pack is its condition. One side of the strap appears to have been damaged and has what looks like masking tape encircling it to secure it, with a safety pin jutting out. The zipper has a safety pin through it, perhaps to help apply pressure and make it slide open more easily. The bag does appear to be worn, making many wonder, what was so important about this particular pack that Jane Doe went through the trouble to keep it together and bring it to the site of her death? The woman herself appeared well kept and didn't look to the detectives as though she was a drifter of any kind. The victim, who would eventually be called Jane Doe, was dressed in expensive clothing. A teal-colored, all-weather-style Eddie Bauer hooded jacket, sized medium. Beneath that, a Classiques and Cheer brand sweater, size large in navy blue. For the record, Classiques and Cheer is a brand sold at Nordstrom. Then, there was a red sweater, same brand, extra large size, both sweaters being over top of a red sleeveless silk shirt of the same brand. On her lower body, Jane Doe wore blue knit wool pants, same brand, over knee-high stockings. Jane Doe also wore a pair of black loafers size 7 medium, a white bra, no brand tag found, and white Fruit of the Loom branded underwear. The Namus entry stated that her clothing may have come from an upscale store such as Saks Fifth Avenue, though I'm unsure of what particular shop was selected. A quick search for a silk sleeveless top like the one worn by Jane Doe pops up with a base price today of $268. In terms of jewelry, Jane Doe wore two clip-on earrings, a Guess brand watch with a mesh band, a 14-karat gold ring with four jade stones set in it, and a single medical alert bracelet, which was branded with the notation, "No code, DNR, no penicillin." No code DNR alerts medical workers that should this particular person be found with no heartbeat or not breathing, they are not to try and resuscitate the victim. Bifocals were also found, though I've not found anything to specify if Jane Doe was wearing them at the time or if they were among her personal effects. While the scene itself was strange and certainly mysterious, there was one detail which investigators believed was quite clear. Jane Doe had likely taken her own life. A plastic bag was found over her head, and the masking tape from her backpack had apparently been used to try and seal the bag around her neck to ensure suffocation. In Jane Doe's pockets, detectives found two envelopes, each containing a single $50 bill and the same tight note, which read, "Deceased by own hand. Prefer no autopsy. Please order cremation with funds provided. Thank you. Jane Doe." One envelope had been addressed to the coroner, while the other had been addressed to the cemetery itself. Whether or not this $100 was all that Jane Doe had access to remains unknown. However, in 1996, the price for cremation was not quite that cheap. Today, the average cost for cremation ranges between $2,000 and $4,000. Later testing would show that, at the time of her death, Jane Doe had a blood alcohol content of 0.14, with 0.08 being the legal limit, meaning that Jane was nearly twice that limit at the time. In addition to alcohol, apparently brandy based on the recovery of a white plastic bottle with a screw top cap, sometimes described as a flask, Jane Doe had also consumed Valium in what has since been ruled to have been a suicide. Further searching of the victim's pockets and personal effects failed to provide any further clues. However, a poem located at the scene reads as follows, quote, "Now I lay me down to sleep, soon to drift to the eternal deep. And though I die and shall not wake, sleep sweeter will be than this life I forsake." End quote. Despite exhaustive efforts by both police and civilians alike, no appearance of this poem has ever been located, which seems to imply that the victim wrote it herself. The poem had been written on a typewriter. You may be wondering if the notes in the envelope were typed, but I can't answer that for you, as I can't find that information. And while an image of the poem exists, there doesn't appear to be any public images of the notes. Jane Doe was ultimately described as being a white female between the ages of 50 and 70 years old, standing 5 feet tall and weighing approximately 157 pounds. Her hair was close-cropped and short, described as curly and auburn or red, though Namus does specify at the time her hair color was close to copper. Her fingernails were also painted red and did not appear to be heavily flaked or scratched. Beyond that, Jane Doe had an 8-inch scar running along the midline of her abdomen, believed at first to be the result of a C-section, suggesting the possibility that she had been a mother at one time, or perhaps still was. That final detail adds a sense of curiosity since, as I stated previously, the location she allegedly selected to take her own life was the section of the cemetery specifically set for the burial of children. However, there is some debate about Jane Doe's scar, as some in the medical field have stated that while it could be a C-section scar, it could also suggest the possibility that at some time the victim had an operation related to her intestines, as the scar does curve around the navel. I should note, however, the location of her remains has been specified as being amongst the graves of the children, but not close to any particular headstone, and no link has ever been discovered between the children buried in that area and Jane Doe, though most of the headstones in that area she was found in were fairly recent. Perhaps it was more the location in which she was found that influenced opinion of her scar more than anything else. It was believed at the time that Jane Doe had come into the cemetery sometime during the night, laid the plastic sheet down, set the Christmas tree in place, either began drinking brandy or had already been drinking, chased the Valium with it, put on her headphones, began playing the comedy tape, and then placed the bag over her head, used the tape to try and secure it all, before lying down and drifting off into unconsciousness, and then death as she slowly suffocated. What events culminated in her life that led her down this path remain unknown, as does her identity. A search of missing persons reports from the area failed to return anyone detectives felt matched the victim, and when her information was sent out nationwide, again, no missing person has ever been confirmed. In fact, according to Namus, as of today, Jane Doe has been excluded as being 619 missing people via DNA comparison. Her true identity has remained a mystery until today. Case update. On Thursday, July 7th, 2022, Annandale Jane Doe, or the Christmas Tree Lady as she is sometimes referred, was positively identified through DNA as being Joyce Marilyn Meyer Summers. In January of 2022, Othram Labs, a Houston-based lab who has shown much success through their use of genetic genealogy, took on the case of Annandale Jane Doe. According to the Washington Post, just 5 months later, in May, Othram got a potential hit on the unknown woman's DNA. At the time, there was a match to an 88-year-old man living in Virginia Beach. His name was David Meyer, and according to their work, Othram believed this man could be the unknown woman's brother. After being notified of the potential match, Fairfax cold case homicide detectives made the drive to Virginia Beach to speak with David. They brought with them a color drawing of Jane Doe, which had been created in hopes of making identification easier and had previously been circulated to the local community and via the internet. Unfortunately, David was unable to confirm that the woman in the image was his sister. According to the Post, Mr. Meyer told investigators that his sister had distanced herself from the family and he hadn't seen her in nearly 50 years. As a result, he couldn't say beyond the shadow of a doubt that the woman in the composite was in fact his sister. Detectives remained convinced that there was a link between Jane Doe and Meyer, and after additional conversations with David, his wife directed investigators to one of David's sisters living outside of Phoenix, Arizona. Investigators then spoke to the sister, Annette Meyer Clue. Upon being shown the composite, Annette told detectives that she was 1,000% certain that the woman in the image was her older sister, Joyce Marilyn Meyer Summers. In order to confirm the identification, Annette submitted a DNA sample, which was to be compared to the Annandale Jane Doe. Carla Davis, a forensic genetic genealogist, was able to confirm the suspicions of both investigators and Annette. This was, in fact, her sister, who no one in the family had heard from or seen since the 1980s. Asked her reaction to this startling news, Annette told the Post, quote, "I was stunned, just stunned. The family had looked for her. They were still looking for her a year after she had died. I'm relieved to know that something horrible didn't happen to her. It sounds like something she'd been planning for a long time." End quote. Joyce Marilyn Meyer was born on Wednesday, July 20th, 1927, in Davenport, Iowa, to parents Arthur Edward and Margaret Josephine Meyer, who were 26 and 25 years old. Joyce was the couple's first child and would ultimately go on to have two younger sisters and two younger brothers, making her the eldest of five. Speaking to the Post, Annette explained that Joyce had grown up with her siblings on a farm outside of Davenport. After completing high school, Joyce attended Iowa State University and later moved away, settling in Los Angeles, California. An aunt lived in the area, and Joyce stayed with her, eventually getting a job working for 17 Magazine. Annette felt this type of job would work well for her sister, telling the Post, quote, "She was very creative and very smart. She was artistic," end quote. Following her time at 17 Magazine, Joyce made a dramatic career shift and started working as a second grade teacher at a Catholic school in the LA area. According to Annette, This wasn't an easy transition for Joyce, who struggled mightily to keep up with the demand of the job and trying to organize her classes. Annette explained, quote, "It was difficult. She had 60 second graders, and she didn't have a background in education. She was very meticulous, staying up until the wee hours to do lesson planning," end quote. Joyce worked as a teacher during the 1950s, and everything seemed to be moving along well until the later years of the decade. According to Annette, Joyce began seeing a psychiatrist around this time. While for some, a stigma remains today, back in the 1950s, people generally thought of psychology as something that was only needed for crazy people, and it was highly looked down on. Annette explained that as Joyce continued seeing the psychiatrist, she began distancing herself more and more from the family. This continued until Joyce eventually lashed out at her mother, telling her that she had been a terrible parent and essentially blaming her for many of her life's problems. Annette explained, quote, "It was just awful. It broke my mother's heart," end quote. Annette explained that this was really the time where Joyce essentially severed herself from the family. She continued to write letters to her older sister, but she rarely received any reply. Even when Joyce did write back, she revealed almost nothing about her life, and so what she was up to and how her life was going were questions that never received answers. Sometime during the 1960s, Joyce moved out of California and headed north, settling in the Seattle area of Washington. Apparently, it was there that Joyce would meet and marry James Elmer Summers, though she never told her family about the wedding, nor apparently about James himself. In their research into Joyce, investigators managed to track down seemingly the only physical connection between Joyce and James, a divorce certificate showing that the couple officially went their separate ways in 1977 and that their marriage had not resulted in any children. Joyce was now 50 years old, divorced, and on her own again. By what way, no one can be certain. She left the American Northwest and headed more than 1,500 miles south, settling in Tucson. According to Annette, her sister wasn't very happy with the way her life had gone to that point, and by the early 1980s, she was living in a Tucson-area trailer park. Annette explained that it would be in that trailer park that the family would have their last contact with Joyce. Sometime during the early 1980s, Joyce invited her family to come down and visit her. All of the siblings came along, and for a time, it was a nice little reunion, but things quickly turned south. According to Annette, while they were visiting, Joyce tried to convince her siblings to build her a house so she didn't have to live in the trailer park. This was not exactly a family made up of well-to-do people with money to spare, so when they explained to Joyce that they couldn't afford to help her in the way she wanted, she turned cold. Annette told the Post, quote, "After that visit, she dropped off the face of the earth," end quote. No one in the family ever heard from Joyce again. By the early 1990s, her family had made several efforts to track her down. One of her brothers, Larry, traveled back to Tucson and found her old trailer abandoned and in rough shape. According to Annette, in an old refrigerator in the trailer, Larry found several copies of a book entitled The Target Child. This was apparently a book Joyce had self-published, in which she went into great detail about her traumatic childhood and upbringing. Annette, however, struggled to understand the book as, according to her, she and her siblings grew up in a loving home with two parents who were caring and attentive, not abusive or cold. Without knowing where Joyce may have gone, Larry and Annette's now ex-husband pooled some funds together and hired a private investigator to try and track down the missing sister. Annette and her siblings believed at the time that Joyce may have fallen in with a cult. While the private investigator was able to find some traces of Joyce, suggesting she may have moved to the East Coast, they had no idea where she might be or what condition she was in. Unfortunately, that's where it ended for them, as Joyce had seemingly vanished, with Annette explaining, quote, "They never found her anywhere. The case was cold," end quote. As it turned out, her family may have been looking for her as recently as the year she died. According to investigators, they have found public records documents which suggest that Joyce settled in the Virginia area and may have been living there in 1996 in Alexandria. They also found an address which led to an old townhouse in Washington, D.C. Somehow, though through what exact methods no one knows, Joyce winded up selecting the child section of Pleasant Valley Memorial Park in Annandale to spend the final moments of her life. While her name has been restored, much of the life and last years of Joyce Marilyn Myers Summers remains a mystery, and more than likely, will never be fully unraveled. Detectives investigating the case have noted that they couldn't establish any connection between Joyce and any of the graves that she selected to die beside. According to Annette, her family is unaware of her ever having a child, though detectives continue to believe that a large scar found on her stomach may be the result of a cesarean childbirth. Of course, with someone whose life has been so wrapped in mystery, there's no way of knowing for certain at this time. Annette speculated that perhaps her sister had selected the children's section of the cemetery as somewhat of a symbolic nod towards her belief that children can become permanently and inalterably damaged by their parents and their upbringing. While the identification is something many have sought for decades, it reveals little to explain what ultimately led to the end of Joyce's life, nor what was behind this clearly intricate plan she developed to die and go unknown. What we do know is that Joyce was 69 years old in 1996 when she was discovered lifeless in the cemetery. Her family believes that she moved east sometime after the mid-1980s, though for what reason they can't say. At the time, there were no relatives living in the area, and thus far no records have been uncovered revealing what Joyce did in Virginia, nor how long she lived there. Joyce had never been reported as a missing person. In an agency press release, Major Ed O'Carroll of the Fairfax Police Department's Major Crimes, Cyber, and Forensics Unit announced, quote, "After decades of wondering what happened to their loved one, Joyce's family is finally at peace, thanks to the dedicated work of several generations of FCPD detectives, anonymous donors, and Othram. Our detectives never stopped working for Joyce and her family. Advances in technology will continue to help close cases and provide answers to victims' families." End quote. As time moves forward, I imagine many details of Joyce's life will be uncovered. But as it stands today, the mystery of the Annandale Jane Doe has been partially solved, and Joyce Marilyn Meyer Summers has had her name returned to her. Episode 113, The Abduction of Kelly Berg Dove. Kelly Dove turned and walked out from behind the counter. Several hours earlier, she had come to work at the Imperial Gas Station in Harrisonburg, Virginia, after trading shifts with her sister. In fact, two of Kelly's sisters worked at the same gas station, and it wasn't out of the ordinary for them to switch off here and there. The 20-year-old made the short walk from the counter to the wall-mounted payphone, picked up the receiver, and quickly punched in 911. It was early on the morning of Friday, June 18th, 1982, when the 911 operator answered. This was hardly Kelly's first overnight shift, and according to her mother, Rachel, Kelly was a smart young woman who wasn't afraid to be the lone employee working at night. Just 3 hours earlier, Rachel had called her daughter to check on her, but Kelly had been too busy to talk. Around midnight, Kelly called back, and according to Rachel, everything seemed fine. There was no indication of any problems, and it was just another routine night. However, by 2:27 a.m., something had occurred which made Kelly, who wasn't easily frightened, find it necessary to call the police. According to official statements and articles written about this case, Kelly reported to this Harrisonburg police that she'd been on the receiving end of multiple anonymous harassing phone calls, and there was a suspicious male hanging around outside of the building. It has been suggested in several articles that the harassing phone calls may have been coming from the man outside using a payphone attached to the exterior of the building. The gas station was located at 2141 South Main Street in Harrisonburg, approximately a mile south of James Madison University. Multiple accounts describe the location as being isolated along a vacant stretch of road. The gas station itself has since been torn down. An overgrowth of trees consumes much of the former property, with only a paved black tar square and gravel remaining of the sloped entryways from the main road. The Harrisonburg Police Department is located just 3 miles away on North Main Street. Reportedly, Kelly told authorities that she was working alone and requested that they come by. According to an article in the Daily Press, Kelly stated that a man had come in earlier and was improperly dressed. She ignored him, but she thought that might be the same guy driving through the parking lot before she made the call. She requested that police send somebody by to check on her. This would be the first in a trio of phone calls Kelly made that night, the night she disappeared. All of the calls would be made within minutes of each other, depending on which reports you rely on, as there are several time discrepancies. However, while the first call was made with concern, the next would increase in intensity. While the harassing calls may seem like a cause for concern, Kelly's sister Debbie, a manager at the same gas station, later told the news leader paper that they were mostly part of the job, saying, quote, "We get those all the time," end quote. However, in the call, Kelly mentioned that the man had been improperly dressed, and while there have been some debates about what that meant, both investigators and the family have concluded that the man may have exposed himself to Kelly. Regardless, when the police arrived at the gas station that night, Kelly and this mysterious man were both gone, and 40 years later, Kelly has never been found, nor her abductor identified. Case update. June of 2022 marked 40 years since 20-year-old Kelly Berg Dove mysteriously vanished from her shift at the Imperial gas station. Following multiple calls to 911, police arrived on the scene to find the gas station abandoned and any trace of Kelly gone. For four decades, investigators and her family have tried to unravel the mystery of her disappearance, which police classified as an abduction back in 1982. Speaking to WHSV Channel 3, Kelly's sister Elaine discussed the difficulty and the pain of those questions, asking, quote, "Where is she? Who did this? Why will we ever find her?" End quote. Just a few weeks ago, in June of 2022, for the first time since her disappearance, investigators decided to release their recording of the first 911 call Kelly made in the early morning hours the day she vanished. This call came in at 2:27 a.m., and I will now play it for you.
I'm working the third shift at the Imperial gas station. I just had an obscene phone call, and this guy came in earlier, and he was kind of dressed improperly, but I kind of ignored him. I think it was that guy, because he just drove through the parking lot a few seconds before I got the call. You have somebody kind of keep an eye out on me?
Okay, this is on
Main Street.
South Main?
Uh-huh. Over beside McDonald's. Thank you. Bye.
So, just in case you couldn't understand everything said there, I know 911 calls can be a little difficult to understand sometimes. I'm going to read you the transcript of this call, which goes as follows. Quote, "I'm working the third shift at the Imperial gas station. I just had an obscene phone call. This guy came in earlier, and he was kind of dressed improperly, but I kind of ignored him. I think it was that guy, because he drove through the parking lot a few seconds before I got the call. Could you have somebody come keep an eye on me?" End quote. According to investigators, an officer was dispatched to the location at that time. Kelly's second call to 911 came in just 2 minutes later at 2:29 a.m. While detectives have not yet released the audio of the second call, they noted that Kelly described the man from the first call and stated that he was driving a silver Ford. Police arrived on the scene 2 minutes later at approximately 2:31 a.m., just 4 minutes after Kelly's first call. However, they found only an empty gas station and no sign of the 20-year-old mother of one. While police worked hard to try and find the man who had abducted Kelly, they consistently hit dead ends with their leads, and the case quickly grew cold. Several years later, in 1989, with no new progress on the case, the missing mother was officially declared dead. Brooke Wetherell, a detective with the Harrisonburg Police Department's Major Crimes Unit, discussed how the case and investigation have developed. According to Wetherell, investigators in 1982 were able to put together a composite image based upon an eyewitness description. This witness had been subjected to indecent exposure from the man she described not far from where Kelly had been abducted. And at the time, investigators thought there was a good possibility that they were one in the same man. According to Wetherell, cold case investigators digging back into Kelly's abduction were able to find some possible links between the suspect in the composite and Kelly's disappearance. In conjunction with the witnesses, the composite, and with information gathered from the Department of Motor Vehicles, investigators believe they had narrowed the suspect pool to one individual. This, however, does not confirm that they have the person who is responsible for Kelly's disappearance. Detective Wetherell explained, quote, "You could have an outlier. This could be part of a serial killing from someone who traveled up and down the East Coast in the 80s. There's always that possibility. So for us, we're combating not only the local suspects that we have weeded out over the years, but forensics." End quote. Wetherell went on to explain that they were racing against the clock in this case, as with 40 years having passed, both witnesses and potential suspects are passing away or their memories are failing, and their ability to conduct full interviews are withering. While investigators do have a name, they've elected not to share it until further evidence is gathered. They did, however, release the composite sketch, which appears to show a white male, approximately 5 feet 10 inches tall, with a thin build and dirty, shoulder-length blonde hair. According to Wetherell, the cold case team working on Kelly's abduction have been in regular communication with forensics labs about what materials can be tested before the passing of 4 decades degrades it further. Wetherell continued, quote, "I do think we're in such a position that we have so much more at our fingertips now that we're in a better position to solve the case, better than we have been in the past." End quote. Kelly's family continues to encourage anyone with information to come forward. After all of these years, they want to finally know what happened to Kelly, to give her a proper burial, and to see the man responsible face justice for stealing away their beloved sister, daughter, and mother. Asked her thoughts on these new revelations, Kelly's sister Elaine replied, quote, "As far as a suspect, I have a gut feeling that it's the right one. Some people say, well, isn't the hope gone? It's been 40 years. I don't think the hope ever goes away. I think sometimes it gets distant for a while, and then you think, you gotta keep holding this hope. Keep this hope alive." End quote. On Saturday, June 25th, Kelly's family held an event at Wildwood Park in Bridgewater to remember Kelly and celebrate her life. Asked about the event, Elaine told Channel 3, quote, "It's not to grieve over Kelly. She would want us to keep living. And so I want to celebrate her memory is what I want to do. And let people know she's still out there somewhere. And whoever did this is as well." End quote. The family hopes that renewed attention on the case and the release of the 911 call and the composite image might help jumpstart the investigation and finally lead them to the answers they have sought for over 4 decades. Kelly Berg Dove vanished in the early morning hours of Friday, June 18, 1982, from the former Imperial gas station on South Main Street in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Her family, over the years, have speculated their belief that the man responsible may have been someone she had gone to school with. Whether or not this person is the suspect investigators have narrowed things down to remains to be seen. Hopefully, these are the first new developments that will ultimately lead to the truth finally being revealed. We'll move into our final case update after a quick word from this week's sponsors. I love that sound. It's the sound of another sale on Shopify, the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big businesses, so upstarts, startups, and established businesses alike can sell everywhere, synchronize online and in-person sales, and effortlessly stay informed. Scaling your business is a journey of endless possibility. I love how Shopify has the tools and resources that make it easy for any business to succeed, from down the street to around the globe. Reach customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps, including Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, and more. Gain insights as you grow with detailed reporting of conversion rates, profit margins, and beyond. More than a store, Shopify grows with you. That is possibility powered by Shopify. Go to shopify.com/trace, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/trace right now. Shopify.com/trace. Making content is an essential part of what I do to keep this show going, but it hasn't always been a seamless creative process. Each week, I create new graphics, videos, audiograms, and more. It can be an overwhelming process trying to create professional graphics with intermediate skill. However, ever since I found Canva Pro, I can design anything like a pro on any device. Canva Pro is a design platform that empowers you to create and share stunning content in just a few clicks. Designing with Canva Pro is amazingly fast and fun. Choose from thousands of templates that are easy to customize or start from scratch. Canva Pro has endless premium fonts, photos, videos, and so much more that add personality and edge to whatever you're designing. There's such a wide variety of tools, features, and images that I have virtually endless options. No more paying for images or hiring designers. With Canva Pro's content planner, you'll save time planning, creating, and posting social media content too. Pause scheduled posts and edit them at any time. My favorite Canva Pro feature is Magic Resize. A lot of times I'm working with older, small images, but with Canva Pro, I can resize that image to whatever size I need without losing quality, and that's a remarkable feature to utilize. Design like a pro with Canva Pro. Right now, you can get a free 45-day extended trial when you use my promo code. Just go to canva.me/trace to get your free 45-day extended trial. That's canva.me/trace. canva.me/trace. When they say mental health is a journey, they mean it. That's why it's important to prioritize your mental health and wellness every day. When you work on yourself, it brings positive changes in all areas of your life. The long-term effects of therapy can give you the tools to deal with challenges as they arise, strengthen your relationships, and give you a more positive outlook on life. There's no better time to invest in yourself than right now. Talkspace is the number one online therapy platform that has thousands of licensed therapists trained in over 40 specialties, including anxiety, depression, relationships, and more. Your therapist can help you set and achieve your goals. Talkspace is a fraction of the cost of in-person therapy. Instead of waiting for an appointment, you can send unlimited messages to your therapist 24/7, and they'll engage with you daily, 5 days a week. Talkspace has thousands of licensed therapists with years of experience in over 40 specialties, including depression, anxiety, substance abuse, trauma, anger management, relationship issues, food and eating, and so much more. As a listener of Trace Evidence, you'll get $100 off your first month with Talkspace. To match with a licensed therapist, go to Talkspace.com. Make sure to use the code TRACE to get $100 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's TRACE and Talkspace.com. Episode 75, The Disappearance of Christian Ferguson. In episode 75, I examined the case of 9-year-old Christian Ferguson, which quickly became one of the most disturbing, upsetting, and haunting cases I've ever covered. Christian, who suffered from a metabolic disorder which left him disabled, allegedly vanished on June 11, 2003. Christian, who was in the company of his father, DeJuan Ferguson, was reportedly left in DeJuan's SUV. DeJuan alleged that Christian was having a medical emergency, and so he placed his 9-year-old son in the car and began the drive to the hospital. However, along the way, DeJuan claimed to have stopped the SUV in order to call ahead and notify the hospital. It was during this phone call that DeJuan alleged the SUV was stolen, with Christian still inside. Later, during the investigation, police would discover no call had been made from that payphone to the hospital. 2 hours after the alleged abduction, DeJuan's SUV was located just 5 miles from the payphone, parked at the end of a cul-de-sac near railroad tracks. Police were immediately suspicious of the story as, when the SUV was found, Only Christian himself appeared to be missing. Left behind in the vehicle were multiple items of value, including two cell phones, a laptop, a digital camera, and yet the 9-year-old was nowhere to be found. While the search for Christian was thorough and extensive, no trace of the child could be found. However, the more investigators dug into Christian's life, the more disturbing information they found. They discovered multiple reports from nurses that the child wasn't being treated correctly and even had an incredibly heartbreaking interview with Christian's brother, who acknowledged that the younger child had been mistreated, including being undernourished and ignored, leading to Christian's younger brother, 8 at the time, trying to feed him as he could see Christian struggling with hunger. To hear the full details of this case, please go back and listen to episode 75. Though I will warn you now, it's an extremely disturbing and upsetting case that involves terrible treatment and abuse directed at a disabled 9-year-old child. Suspicions at the time revolved completely around Christian's father. I went in detail pointing out written statements and verbal ones from law enforcement and medical professionals who doubted the story about the SUV being stolen, as well as questioning the health status of Christian on the morning he was allegedly abducted. Investigation would later show that a vehicle, located near the payphone, belonged to a woman that Dewan had an intimate relationship with, and that Dewan had the keys to the car. It was also noted that this woman lived close to the location where the SUV was ultimately found. At one point during the initial part of the investigation, Dewan was asked to take a polygraph test. It was at this time that he pulled back from cooperating with investigators and hired an attorney. When Christian's younger brother, who had talked about sneaking food to the sick child, was spoken to by investigators, he reported that he shared a room with Christian and that on the morning in question, he remembered Dewan entering the room, wrapping Christian up in a blanket, and taking him out of the home. One of Dewan's stepdaughters, Deshonda, who was 16 at the time, reported that on that same morning, she was awoken around 4 a.m. to the sound of Dewan's SUV starting up and driving away. Dewan's 911 call to report the crime came in at 6:09, leaving a two-hour window during which time neither Christian nor Dewan's locations could be verified. There were many questions floating around. There were doubts that Christian was alive when he was taken out of the house. There were those who suspected he may have been experiencing a medical issue, which, due to neglect, led to his death. And then there were those who believed that Christian was outright murdered and disposed of, with the SUV theft story being a complete cover-up. Christian's mother, Theta, who had fought long and hard for custody of her son, seriously doubted the story and always believed that Dewan knew more than he was telling. On Thursday, October 3rd, 2019, 16 years after Christian's bizarre disappearance, his father, Dewan Ferguson, was arrested and charged with one count of first-degree murder. Nearly 3 years later, in June of 2022, Dewan finally had his day in court. Case update. Opening arguments in the trial were very much what one might expect. The prosecution argued that Dewan's story about his SUV being stolen while Christian was inside was a lie, alleging that Dewan had instead murdered his 9-year-old son and disposed of his remains in a yet undiscovered location. The defense countered, claiming that Dewan was a caring and loving father who was despised by Christian's mother, his ex-wife Theta, who had made it her goal to ensure that he was charged with a murder he didn't commit. Assistant St. Louis County Prosecutor John Schlesinger told the jury that they would be hearing evidence proving that Dewan's SUV was parked exactly where police later found it 4 hours before he ever called 911 to report his son missing, and that he confided in a lover that police would never find the body. The prosecution showed evidence which revealed that a car found parked not far from the payphone Dewan used that day in fact belonged to a close friend of his, and that this friend lived only blocks from where the SUV was found. Ultimately, the state would acknowledge two witnesses who both saw the SUV where it was later found hours before sunrise. In response, Dewan's public defender, Jamia Steele, argued that police were under the influence of Theta, telling the jury, quote, "The state has a lot of suggestions, rumors, innuendos, but they don't have any evidence," end quote. During court proceedings, there were many times in which Judge Brian May had to call both sides to the bench to try and get the situation under control. When Theda was called to the stand, it seemed that the defense had planned to try and destroy her reputation, believing that without her, the prosecution had no case. Judge May, however, had to frequently remind the defense that Theda was not on trial, and Steele needed to stop attempting to admit hearsay as evidence. The prosecution continued to object to questions put forth by Steele, and Judge May had to instruct the jury to disregard her questions several times. Steele attempted to show that there was a contentious relationship between Theda and her other child, Connor, who is today her daughter, Lynn. Prosecutors argued that Lynn planned to testify to hearing a struggle between her brother and father the night before Christian was reported missing. Defense attorney Steele argued that on the morning of the disappearance, Dewan noticed something was wrong with Christian and, not having minutes on his cell phone, decided to stop at a payphone on Page Boulevard to call ahead to notify the hospital that he was bringing in his son, something he claimed to have done before. Steele argued that while he left the vehicle idling, someone had stolen it and driven off. Police located the SUV 2 hours later on Ronbar Lane, but while many items of value had been left, Christian was missing. The prosecution called multiple witnesses who were there to testify as to Christian's physical health and the conditions in which he was living while in Dewan's care. They gave accounts of Christian wearing the same clothes for days at a time, and one described a visit in which she had found Christian's feeding tube lying on the ground, a feeding tube which had been in his stomach just 2 days earlier. One nurse testified that when she tried to obtain additional formula for Christian, she was notified that the child had not been taken to a doctor's visit in over a year. She herself took the child to the doctor, who noted that he appeared to have lost 4 to 5 pounds. In the weeks leading up to Christian's disappearance, there had been issues between Theda and Dewan regarding her right to visitation. A hearing would ultimately be held in which Dewan was ordered to allow Theda to resume visitation. Theda's sister, Sharon William, testified that 2 days before this ruling came down, Dewan had commented to her that Theda would only get to see the kids over his dead body. Much of the trial involved the prosecution building their case, showing evidence that Dewan's story didn't line up with the actual facts of the investigation. The defense, for their part, argued that the state had no evidence. No crime scene, no body, no murder weapon, nothing to prove that Christian was even dead. Throughout the trial, testimony was heard from the police, FBI, Christian's doctors, and several members of the family. Perhaps the most disturbing accounts came from Christian's sister Lynn, who testified that her father often tied her brother to the bed using a comforter. In addition, she reported that Christian was constantly losing weight due to a lack of food and would frequently eat non-food items off the floor and even tear away and eat pieces of his diaper. On the night before Christian was reported missing, Lynn testified that she heard a loud struggle between her brother and father. She then saw Dewan carrying Christian out to the family car, wrapped in a blanket. She stated, quote, "His moaning and groaning got more intense, it seemed, and then all of a sudden it stopped after some kind of struggle," end quote. Following Lynn's testimony, the jury were then shown the video of an interview the FBI had conducted with her in 2003, where she discussed the night before. According to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, one of Christian's nannies had carried out an affair with Dewan during her employment. At one point, she agreed to wear a wire for the FBI in an attempt to get answers out of Dewan regarding Christian's fate. When she asked him what had happened to Christian, Dewan replied, quote, "You know me, I did what I had to do," end quote. Another witness, Santana Contreras, a friend of Dewan's now ex-wife, testified that she'd heard Dewan tell his ex that Christian was dead before the 911 call was made. At the time, Contreras stated she didn't tell police because she was so afraid of Dewan, she ultimately moved away and changed her name on Facebook so he couldn't find her. After a brutally difficult trial in which the true horrors Christian was subjected to were revealed, each side made their closing arguments, and the jury retired to deliberate. Then, on Friday, July 1st, they returned. DeJuan Ferguson was found guilty of first-degree murder after only 3 hours of deliberation. Being that the prosecution did not seek the death penalty, DeJuan will receive a mandatory sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. At this time, the location of Christian's remains is unknown, and whether or not revealing that information might result in an adjustment of the sentence remains to be seen. Following the trial, Assistant Prosecutor John Schlesinger answered questions from the media. Asked about the guilty verdict, Schlesinger replied, quote, "All I can say is that we are very pleased that we were finally able to bring Christian and his family some justice. That child's life was punishment. What he had to endure and suffer was cruel and inhumane," end quote. It's been a long, difficult, and painful process for Christian's mother. Asked about the whirlwind of emotions she was feeling as the verdict was read, Theda told KSDK Channel 5 News, quote, "I'm just grateful that we had jurors who did their jobs and made sure that justice was served as much as possible for our family," end quote. While DeJuan has been found guilty, the investigation is not officially over. Until Christian's remains are found and returned to his family so that he might receive a proper burial, the search for the 9-year-old boy murdered by his own father will continue. DeJuan is not done in court either. On August 1st, DeJuan will once again go before a judge as a second trial begins. This one stems from a separate arrest in which DeJuan was charged with 2 counts of rape, 2 counts of statutory sodomy, and second-degree child molestation after police say that, between May of 2008 and 2010, he sexually assaulted a child younger than 14, and that victim became pregnant and had a child. Police say DeJuan continued to assault the victim between May 2010 and 2013, when the victim was younger than 17 years old. Police say he also sexually abused another victim, who was younger than 17, between September of 2000 and 2003. It seems quite obvious that DeJuan Ferguson deserves to spend the rest of his life looking out on the world through barred windows. You ask what kind of a man could kill his disabled 9-year-old son? Exactly this type of monster. Two difficult, disturbing, and haunting mysteries have now been solved, at least partially. With DeJuan Ferguson found guilty for the murder of his son Christian, and the Annandale Jane Doe positively identified as Joyce Marilyn Meyer Summers, we move a few steps closer to seeing and trying to understand the truth. As always, should there be any additional updates, I'll bring them to you as they come out. Originally, I had planned a different episode for this week, but I received a ton of messages asking me to update Christian's case as soon as possible. This is a case which has stayed with me and continues to be one of the hardest and most emotionally challenging that I've ever covered. Hopefully soon, Christian will be found. In the abduction of Kelly Berg Dove, authorities and her family continue to seek assistance from the public. Someone out there knows what happened that night in 1982 and has kept it to themselves for 40 years now. It's time to come forward, share information, and help bring closure to her family and justice to the man responsible for her disappearance. If you have any information about the abduction of Kelly Berg Dove, please contact the Harrisonburg Police Department at 540-437-2600. Her case number is 1982-681-146. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Donna Buttram, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Eloanne Meyer, Eric Sumpter, Guillerme Pinto, Haley Christie, James, Jen Treb, Jennifer Winkler, Jill Sense, Joni Berkowitz, Julie Mangano, Kara Moreland, Lars Jensen Fangel, Leslie B., Marla Wright, Melissa Brakeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Orange Patches, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stacy Finnegan, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Adorable Susie Summers, Taylor, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. This completes our look into these three major case updates. Hopefully, as the year goes on, we'll have a lot more updates to share. Next week, I'll be back on my normal schedule releasing episode 199. So thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.